Good evening, folks. As Sanghanista says, I'm going to talk this evening about what is Buddhism. So what is Buddhism? That's quite a big subject, actually, as you can probably realise. What is Buddhism extends over 2,500 years. It's covered over half the face of a planet, and it involves millions upon millions of human beings, right from the day the Buddha gained enlightenment to us here and now. So what I'm going to do is not give you a history lesson, and I'm not going to give you lots of lists and facts and figures. I'm going to do something else. What I'm going to seek to do, what I'm going to endeavour to do, is communicate some of the key principles of Buddhism, some of the key principles of the Dharma. And I'm going to focus on principles for a number of reasons. Firstly, because I genuinely believe that's what the Buddha did. The Buddha principally taught in terms of principles and then applied them to specific people's lives. And also within that, our teacher Sangharakshita even more explicitly focused on principles. So I feel quite safe in doing this as a means of communicating about what is Buddhism, because I'm following in the footsteps of my teachers. So just to say, why did the Buddha focus on principles? Why did he focus on principles? I think the reason he did this is because it encourages responsibility. If you're presented with a principle, you have to work out how it applies to your life. If you're given a rule, it's straightforward. It's just like, do this, do that. It doesn't encourage autonomy. It doesn't encourage thought. It doesn't encourage, well, personal responsibility, and that consequently makes it a much less effective means of achieving what the Buddha sought to achieve, which is our growth and our development. So I'm going to focus on principles because they give you an opportunity to think through, well, how does this apply to my life? How is this relevant? And that is why Buddhism, I believe, has been so successful, because if you focus on principles, it is therefore adaptable. So the fact that the Buddha was teaching 2,500 years ago in a primitive society on the Ganges Basin, because he spoke in terms of principles, what he said to people then applies to us today. If he gave rules, then it would be much harder to see how those, what he was saying, applies to us. But because he spoke in terms of principles, we can apply those principles to our lives. So this evening, I'm speaking to all of you, of course. It's worth just acknowledging that there is a range of experience in the room right now. As we heard on Friday night, we've got some of you here who, if this is literally your first contact with Buddhism or first contact with people who are living a Buddhist life outside of books, and we've got people like that, and we've got Sumana sitting over there who's been ordained longer than I've been alive. So I'm speaking to quite a wide range of experience here. I think that's fantastic, actually. I think it's a real benefit, as Stiramani said. It's one of the real benefits of this retreat, because it allows all of us to be informed by each other. Youth has something to say to experience, and experience has something to give to youth and inspiration. That said, within this talk, I'm naturally going to seek to focus more on those of you who are newer to Buddhism, because you're the ones who have got, well, who will most freely benefit from gaining some more information, gaining some new perspectives. But of course, it's worth saying that even for those of us who are more experienced, because we're speaking in terms of principles, you can always take them deeper. Mm. You can always see more clearly just what the Buddha was getting at in that point, or why that was important. Sangharakshita, our teacher, says that we need more and more of less and less. Yeah? The principle of focusing, going deeper. So I'm unapologetic about what I'm going to say. I think hopefully it will be useful for all of you. So the format of what I'm going to do is I'm going to read a section of the Dhammapada. The Dhammapada is an iconic Buddhist text. It's relatively short. It's all in in poetic verses. Makes it quite accessible. It means you don't have to wade through long, complicated things. It's very punchy, it's very direct. It's the Buddha just really giving people very clear teachings. The reason I'm going to talk about the Dhammapada is because I felt it's important that, well, we're talking about what is Buddhism. Well, Buddhism comes from the Buddha. That it's important to grasp it. It's not coming from me. It's not my ideas. It's not Sangharakshita, the man who founded this Buddhist tradition's ideas. It is the word of the Buddha. And the Buddha is worth hearing because he's wiser than me, obviously. And the reason the Buddha's worth hearing is because the Buddha is, as I was saying last night, the Buddha was a human being who became more than a human being. At least that's what we believe. The Buddha was a man who, through his own courage and determination and energy and creativity, realised a radically different state of consciousness. He attained Buddhahood. And that state of consciousness, that experience he had, he shared with people who shared it with people who shared it with people who shared it with people, all the way down 2,500 years of history to us sitting here and right now. So the Buddha is a principle of a possibility of human growth. And he is the touchstone of our tradition. We call ourselves Buddhists. We follow the Buddhist path. And that means that we draw our inspiration, the vision and the practices of our life from the Buddha. So it's useful to actually hear a bit about what the Buddha said. So then you can check and say, well, does this stand up? Does it add up? Did the Buddha say that? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read you a section from the Dhammapada called the Mahavagga, the section on the way. And then we'll just have a few minutes to I'll shut up for a few minutes and just let you absorb what the Buddha actually said. Here are his words. And then I'll proceed to, draw out some of the principles of the Buddha's path, what I've been taught that the Buddha's path is from what the Buddha had to say. I won't speak about everything he says because it's too much, it's too long. And then I'll sum up and sort of try and essentialise what I've been talking about. And then we'll sit for maybe somewhere between 5 and 15 minutes, depending on how long I talk for, just absorbing what I've said. And then I'll ring 3 bells, and that'll be the end of the evening, and we'll move into silence and have an opportunity to absorb what's happened today, what's come up for us, things that are of interest that I've been speaking about, or whatever experiences we've had over the course of the day. So, the Mahavagga, the section on the way. Of all the paths, the Eightfold Path is the best. Of all the truths, the Four Noble Truths are the best. Of all things, passionlessness is the best. Of all men, the seeing one, the Buddha, is the best. This is the only path. There is none other for the purification of insight. Tread this path and you will bewilder limitation. Walking upon this path, you will make an end of suffering. Having discovered how to pull out the thorn of lust, I make known the path. You yourselves must strive. The Buddhas only point the way. Those meditative ones who tread the path are released from the bonds of limitation. All conditioned things are impermanent. When one sees this with wisdom, one turns away from suffering. This is the path to purification. All conditioned things are unsatisfactory. When one sees this with wisdom, one turns away from suffering. This is the path to purification. All things are not self. When one sees this with wisdom, one turns away from suffering. This is the path to purification. The idler who does not exert himself when he should, who though young and strong is full of sloth, with a mind full of vain thoughts, such an indolent man does not find the path to wisdom. Let a man be watchful of speech, well controlled in mind, and not commit evil in bodily action. Let him purify these three courses of action and win the path known by the great sage. Wisdom springs from meditation. Without meditation, wisdom wanes. Having known these two paths of progress and decline, let a man conduct himself that his wisdom may increase. Cut down the forest of lust, but not the tree. From the forest springs fear. Having cut down the forest and the underbrush of desire, be passionless, O monks. For so long as the underbrush of desire, even at its most subtle, of a man towards a woman is not cut down, his mind is in bondage, like the suckling calf to its mother. Cut off your sticky attachment in the manner of a man who plucks with his hand an autumn lotus. Cultivate only the path of peace, Nibbana, as made known by the Exalted One. Here shall I live during the rains, here in winter and summer. Thus thinks the fool, he does not realize the danger that death might intervene. As a great flood carries away a sleeping village, so death seizes and carries away the man with a clinging mind, doting on his children and cattle. For him who is assailed by death, there is no protection by kinsmen, nor there are to save him, no sons, no father, no relatives. Realizing this fact, let the wise man, restrained by morality, hasten to clear the path leading to peace, Nibbana. So as I said, I'm not going to speak about every line I've just read out. That would take too long. And there's certain key things that I want to draw out. What I'll do is I'll go through the verses in sequential order. But before that, I do that, I want to speak about one verse in particular. So one of the reasons why I wanted to read this is because it, as I say, it allows us to allows us to have a direct experience as possible of the Buddha himself as a human being communicating to other human beings. So there's a couple of things there. One of them is that he communicated to certain groups of people at certain times. So the text I've just read from, he was speaking to committed male monks. So that's an important point to bear in mind. These are men who'd completely committed their life to Buddhism, and in that cultural context that meant that they didn't work, they didn't have relationships with women or with families, and they spent all their time wandering around living the life of a monk. Yeah, so that's important to bear in mind. Those were the people he was speaking to. So what that means for us is that some of the things he said are quite provocative, quite challenging, because it goes against what we're doing. So specifically when he says, for so long as the underbrush of desire, even at its most subtle, of a man towards a woman is not cut down, his mind is in bondage, like the suckling calf to its mother. Yeah. Now I imagine, for me, when I read that out, I feel quite challenged by that, because it is not what I like to hear. Yeah, I've got a girlfriend, we're going on holiday on Friday, I'm really looking forward to that actually, very excited about that. And yet here we have the Buddha, who is my teacher, saying that if you do that, your mind is like a suckling calf. What do we do about that? What do we do about that? Do we say, oh, the Buddha is wrong and bad, he's talking rubbish? Do we say that we're wrong and bad and we're weak and foolish and we can't practice Buddhism? I'm not satisfied with either of those approaches myself. So what do we do? Well, at this point, what I have to do is just recognise that the Buddha had a really radical message. I need to remember that is true, and I need to remember that I'm where I am and I do the best I can. And be at peace with both sides of that. Yeah. So I need to hold the tension between what the Buddha says and what I do. And in a way, that's all we have to do with that passage. We just have to recognise, well, the Buddha was saying this. He was a wise man. But he was talking to people leading a specific lifestyle, and we have to work out how we apply that in our lives. So it's not just me. The order members, as older members, we've committed our lives to Buddhism. We've been ordained into a Buddhist tradition. That Buddhist tradition does not demand celibacy, because Sangharakshita, our teacher, saw that actually, if you demand celibacy of people, it easily leads to an unintegrated and narrow relationship with ourselves. We're trying to become full. We're trying to become whole. We need to take all of ourselves into our Buddhist practice. And that takes time to resolve our relationship with sex, how we live that out, how we make sense of that part of our lives in a wholesome and pure way, which doesn't leave parts of ourselves behind. And it's not just me who's doing that. Of the 15 men who live and work at Padmaloka, 10 of us are in long-term relationships. 4 of those men are senior teachers in our movement who hold the highest level of responsibility it's possible to hold in our movement. And they're in relationships. They're in good, wholesome, nurturing, satisfying relationships which I believe are good for them, and they're good for the, and they're good relationships for the women they're in as well. And I think in the short term that's a much more realistic objective than a premature adoption of celibacy, whilst also acknowledging that is what the Buddha said is ultimately the best way to practice. So having just spoken on that line out of time, as it were, because I think it's probably a slightly pokey one for some of you, we'll now sort of move through the rest of the text in sequence. Walking upon this path, you will make known an end of suffering. Having discovered to pull out the thorn of lust, I make known the path. So what this verse communicates to me, or the principle I'm going to draw out from this verse, is the possibility of deep transformation, radical transformation. The Buddha talks about making an end of suffering. Yeah, a complete end of suffering, a total end of suffering, a completely different experience of life. So at the moment in the West, Buddhism and meditation is experiencing a real surge of interest in the field of stress relief, dealing with depression, working with pain. Yeah, that's really good. It's fantastic. I'm really, really pleased to see that happening. In a lot of our Buddhist centres, people are really benefiting from those teachings. Maybe some of you have come into contact with Buddhism, or your interest with Buddhism and meditation has come through that direction. That's great. It's really, really good that people are making use of Buddhism and meditation in that way. But, and yet, that is not all that is possible. There's nothing wrong with that. It's great that people make use of Buddhism in that way. And the vision of the Buddha is much, much vaster than that. The vision of the Buddha is of a completely transformed human life, one of limitless energy, creativity, awareness, and love. And it's important to keep hold of that. And that is the end of suffering. So when we talk about suffering, a common misunderstanding of Buddhism is that Buddhism's a bit of a downer. It says, oh, life is suffering, life is painful. Yeah, that's a common misunderstanding of Buddhism. It's obviously not true. Yeah. So just look at your experience over the course of today. We just ate a lovely dinner cooked by Diogina. That wasn't suffering. It was pleasurable. It tasted good. The paella yesterday tasted even better. It was fantastic. Yeah, let's be honest about it. That was good. It was good. It was pleasurable. This afternoon we had a lovely sunny afternoon. Yeah, that was pleasurable, it was good. I'm sure many of you went for little walks or sat in the garden looking at the trees and the flowers. That was pleasurable, it was good. we've spoken with each other, we've interacted with each other. I hope most of those interactions have been pleasurable and enjoyable. So when the Buddha talks about suffering, he's obviously not talking about all of suffering. All of life is not suffering. So when the Buddha talks about suffering, what does he mean? Making an end of suffering, what is that? What in certain strands of the Pali Canon, the oldest teaching of the Buddha talks about his experience of being one of limitation. So he had a rich and positive life, but he realised that he was a bit limited. He wasn't all that he could be. And he wanted more than that. He wanted to be everything he could be. He wanted to fulfil his humanity. And he kept on just pushing into that, those little limitations, those times when you wish you could do that better, or you wish you could be more creative, or you wish you could be more alive. And he kept on going, and he kept on going, until he reached enlightenment. So that's the sort of suffering we're talking about. Just the limitation of not being all that we can be. And that limitation principally occurs within our own minds. So speaking of our own minds, you yourselves must strive. The Buddhas only point the way. Those meditative ones who tread the path are released from the bonds of limitation. So the Buddha realised his potential. He realised the true nature of reality, and he dedicated his life to communicating it to us. We can hear that message, but then we need to put it into practice for ourselves. You know, this section is called the Margavarga, the section on the way. And the Buddha said that that's what he was. He was a Margadatta. He pointed the way. He showed us how we could live our lives. But obviously we have to do it for ourselves. We can choose to. We can make use of the Buddha's teachings to transform our lives. But we have to do it for ourselves. And the emphasis here is on practice. We're talking about the meditative ones, those who meditate, who tread the way. We do these things. We need to embody the teachings of the Buddha. And one of the most important ways in which we embody them, it is by embodying it. So you're hearing me speak about the teachings of the Buddha. We have an opportunity there to take those teachings and bring them into our lives, start living them out, realise what it means for us. We were talking in our group this evening about the difference between things being in our heads and in our hearts. The Buddha's inviting us to take his words into our heart and change the way we live, the way we live. And part of that is why I think it's so important that we relate to the Buddha's teaching as principles, which we find out how they apply to us. Rules don't go into our hearts. Rules stay in our heads. Yeah, do this, don't do that. Whereas principles can come into our hearts and inform the way we live. So what are those principles that inform the way we live? All things are not self. When one sees this with wisdom, one turns away from suffering. This is the path to purification. All things are impermanent. All conditioned things are unsatisfactory. This is the heart of the Buddha's teaching. It was his direct perception of the truth of these three statements which brought about his awakening, which made him the Buddha. So here, this is the heart of the Dharma. This is the pulsating core of the true nature of reality, which is possible for us to tune in with. So how do we do that? How do we take this into our lives? What do we make of this? Well, there's quite a few things to draw out here. And the first one I want to draw out is the fact that the Buddha, following on from what I said in the last section, the Buddha talks about seeing this. When one sees with wisdom, one turns away from suffering. This is the path of purification. This is the path to purification. So this just hammers home even further the fact that the Buddha's teaching needs to be brought into our lives. We can take it on board. We can let it transform ourselves. I've just said something which is fairly straightforward. All conditioned things are impermanent. You think, so what? Big deal. I know that. Yeah. So obviously, what the Buddha's talking about is a much more deeply embodied, fully experienced seeing. Seeing, it's not an idea. We see something. It's a direct, visceral experience. And that's what we need to bring about in ourselves. We need to somehow find a way of coming to actually see and feel the truth of these words. All conditioned things are unsatisfactory. How do we really feel that to be true? How do we really live our lives on the basis of that truth? That's a question for you, which I certainly can't answer here and now. I think one of the main things it points out is that it's about opening up. It's about opening up to seeing things in a different way. And for me, that brings encouragement. The Buddha isn't saying that enlightenment is over there. The Buddha isn't talking about enlightenment being somewhere else. He's talking about it being this experience, this life, this moment experienced in a different way. So that for me is a point of empowerment. It makes it possible. I don't have to go somewhere else. I don't have to be someone else. I just have to do this magic trick of flipping the way I see things so that I see them in a different way. I see them in a fuller way, in a more complete way. So I think that's really important to take on board, that it's that we don't have to go somewhere else. It's just about seeing life in a different way. That's still quite tricky, obviously, but it makes it more possible. So I'm just going to say this again because it is so important. The other thing about this is, obviously you can see from these three statements, all conditioned things are impermanent. All conditioned things are unsatisfactory. All things are not self. These clearly aren't rules. They are principles. The Buddha is describing the way reality is, and he's giving us a choice. We can go with it, or we can fight against it. We can try to make things be permanent. We can hold on to them. We can deny that truth. If we do that, we'll suffer. If we can open up, if we can let go into it, then life will be easier for us. The choice is ours, in every moment, in every day. There's just one more thing I want to draw out from this section, and that is, again, you might be thinking, well, this is, what do I do with this? It's such a big principle. How do I draw it down into my life? Well, I think it's worth bearing in mind that the Buddha was incredibly pragmatic. He taught things for a reason. He taught things because they were useful. He said this himself. He said, I could teach you so many things. I teach you what's useful. So how are these three sentences, these three statements useful? Well, I'll just give you one. All conditioned things are impermanent. Or all things are not self. Why is that useful? The reason it's useful, and this is what the Buddha said, the reason it's useful is because if we are not permanent, if we are not the selves we think we are, that means we can change. That means we can grow. And that means we can develop. And that, if you wanted to sum up Buddhism in a nutshell, in terms of from your side, in terms of pragmatically speaking, all Buddhism really is saying is that you can change for the better. That's all it says, actually. And it says you can change and you can carry on changing forever and ever and ever. So there you go. That's it. That is Buddhism. If you had to say what is Buddhism, that's it. All things change, and you can change for the better. You can grow, you can become happier and more fulfilled. The idler, who does not exert himself when he should, who though young and strong is full of sloth, with a mind full of vain thoughts, such an indolent man does not find the path to wisdom. So this, following on from those previous lines, really just brings home the point I was making about we've got a choice. We can choose to take these teachings as an opportunity to grow. And that's what the Buddha is saying. It's a call to action. It's a call to awareness. We can choose to be full of sloth, let our minds be overcome by vain thoughts, or we can make an effort and we can find a path to wisdom. And I think it's important here to remember he's not being specific. He's not saying he who is mindful of vain thoughts at this time and not that time. It's at any time. At any time we can make an effort. One of the really important Buddhist teachings, I think, from earlier on in the Dhammapada, the Buddha speaks of just as a pot is filled drip by drip, so the mind that is directed towards good is filled with virtue. And the reason I think this is important is because it emphasises the fact that we can, every small action makes a difference. Every time when we're eating together and somebody wants something and you notice that and you pass it to them, that is in a moment of awareness and kindness. That makes a difference. Every time in meditation you realise that your mind has wandered off and you come back to counting, that makes a difference. I think it's really, personally for me, it's really, really important to get hold of this, because Buddhism can seem such a vast thing that we can feel a bit overwhelmed, and we don't have to treat it like that. We can have power. We have the opportunity to change our minds in every second. And that means that we can be positive and we can be optimistic rather than feeling, oh, foolish me, I'm so unwise, or I'm so distracted from meditation, blah, blah, blah. We don't need to tell ourselves that story. We can always do something, and that does make a difference. So what is it that we can do? What does make a difference? Let a man be watchful of speech, when well controlled in mind, and not commit evil in bodily action. Let him purify these three courses of action and win the path made known by the great sage. So here we have, from a practical point of view, a central teaching of Buddhism. The possibility, well, the teaching on ethics, the teaching on how we can attune our body, our speech and our minds with that which is beneficial for us and beneficial for others. So this brings us on to the issue of karma. Yeah? We're talking about ethics. We're talking about the way we act, the way we speak and what we think, which is broadly summed up under the category of karma. Karma is one of those Buddhist words. Well, it's not just a Buddhist word. It's a Sanskrit word which has entered the Western language and is frequently misunderstood. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time going into what we mean by karma, and particularly what the most significant aspect of it is. So karma, in a Buddhist context, is willed action of body, speech and mind. And that, of course, includes positive actions which lead to growth and happiness for ourselves and others, and frustrated, deluded, unhelpful, painful actions which lead to painful responses for ourselves and others. So, I'm going to mention a few key points about karma. The first one I'm going to mention is that Buddhism doesn't identify karma as the only thing which is going on. So people often talk about, oh, it's my karma, oh, it was his karma, oh, it was her karma. Buddhism says, in terms of the Buddhist talk, that in terms of what happens in our lives, there's loads and loads of different things going on. So it may be karma, it may be something else. Yeah, I've got a slightly sore throat. I can feel that I'm on the edge of getting a cold. That could be my karma from a past life, meaning that I did something wrong. Or maybe last week I did something bad to somebody and therefore I'm getting a sore throat. Or it could just be that all of us have come together from across the country and somebody's got a cold virus which my body's not used to, and I've slightly picked it up off of one of you. So that's really important to take on board. karma in a Buddhist context isn't the only thing that's going on. There's the other laws of physics going on, there's the laws of biology, there's the laws of psychology, all of them are influencing us all the time. But karma is the most important one for us because it's the one we've got control over. If I catch a cold or not, I don't have a lot of control over that. I can do something about it if I've caught a cold, but I can't either start or stop it from happening. But I can control, I can direct what I do with my body, my speech and my mind. So that's why karma is so important. So then within karma, there's two different areas in which karma manifests. There's the way in which karma manifests externally, and there's the way in which karma manifests internally. And we can choose which one of those we focus on. Traditionally speaking, people most often speak in terms of karma in terms of the external consequences. So people say, oh, it was my karma. Yeah. Within the Buddhist tradition, you can get very crude examples of that. So somebody hits me or I get sick and I think, oh, it must be my karma. At some point in my life or in some previous life, I hit someone, so now someone's hitting me. That's an extremely crude understanding of karma, obviously. And it's not one which we adhere to, just to be really clear about it. Karma does play itself out externally, obviously, in a diffuse way, in a subtle way. So if you go through life being hateful and cruel and argumentative and irrational, I'm pretty confident that things will not go well for you. Your interactions with other people will be painful. If you go through life being kind and positive and creative, broadly speaking, life will go well for you. But of course that isn't always true, is it? We can all think of examples of people who seem to be, really good people who just get a tough deal. Life doesn't go well for them, actually. Why is that? And you like counterwise, you can think of people who are aggressive, angry, greedy, but they've got all this stuff, they've got all this money, they've got all these women, they've got all this success. So what is going on there, actually? Well, this is where the second side of karma becomes most important. The way in which our actions influence our minds. The ways in which every action of body, speech, and the thoughts that we have subtly influence the texture and the feeling of our mind. And that is unavoidable and unescapable. This is what the Buddhist tradition says is the most important way in which karma acts. And you can see that, can't you? So again, going with the most obvious examples. So, like for me, I think of highly successful drug dealers, you know, these drug barons who've just surrounded with cocaine and got, you know, dozens of beautiful, highly attractive women who've got all this power. Just pause for a second. Wonder what the state of their minds are, actually. What must it be like to live that kind of life? The contraction of your mind, the knowledge that you have done a serious amount of harm to a lot of people to get where you are right now. And consequently, surely, a lot of people are prepared to do quite a lot of harm to you to get what you've got. Yeah. I'm convinced all of those people have very tight, very narrow, very limited minds. Their experience of other human beings is probably quite painful, actually. And that's more important than all of this, you know, all of this bling, all of this stuff they've got. And on the other side, the same is true. There's some of the most moving accounts I've read of Tibetan monks in prison of war camps, Tibetan monks in the hands of the Chinese, really suffering. And you read some of their accounts, and they say, and I've read an account by one man saying the only time he felt that he was in danger was when he almost lost his compassion for those who were harming him. That's quite a thing to say. This is a man who was tortured systematically. I've read accounts of what happened to him. It was really extremely unpleasant. And the only time he was truly afraid was when he felt his mind turning to a mind of hatred. because other than that, he knew that he was safe. Now, obviously, this can be taken wrongly. I'm not saying be a pushover and let people do bad things to you. Obviously, as Buddhists, we have to, you know, we need to stand up for ourselves. The point of this is that it's what you do with your mind that is of crucial importance. So I just want to say one more thing about karma. And that is, the last thing that we can easily do with karma or with our actions is look backwards. Why am I having this experience right now? Oh, it must be what I did in the past. That is predominantly a disempowering way of looking at things, which isn't obviously very helpful. A much more positive, a much more useful way of looking at the teaching of karma is to look forward. How can my actions influence my mind to be more bright and the positive? How can I act now to have a better life tomorrow? That is, as I was saying before, that is proactive, that is creative, that is taking our responsibility for our lives and using it as an opportunity to be more fulfilled, be more creative, have a life of awareness and love. And that's the key point with the teaching of karma, that it's an opportunity to see how we can grow our minds, how we can shape our lives. Cut down the forest of lust, but not the tree. From the forest springs fear. Having cut down the forest and the underbrush of desire, be passionless, O monks. So I've got less to say about this. I think the first thing to bring out is that the Buddha talks about being passionless, being without passion. That, for most of us, is quite a long way down the road, actually. As we've been exploring in these evenings when we're looking at ritual, we need Buddhism is a practice of the whole body, the whole of us. So in the first place, we need to get our passion on board, actually. We need to become passionate to go beyond passion. So I think that's important to bear in mind. I think when the Buddha's talking about lust, what he's talking about really is making a shift from gross passions to subtle passions, from gross lusts to subtle lusts, if you can use that language. And that's about making a shift in intensity of experience. So for some of you, I'm sure it's in your minds that tonight you could have been down the pub watching England playing football. Yeah? And I imagine for some of you, that would have given you a more intense experience of life than listening to me talking about Buddhism. I don't know, some of you. Would it have been a more pleasurable experience or a more painful experience? Well, who knows? But given that it's England playing, we can probably be pretty sure. But if it's not painful now, it'll be painful next time. Let's be honest about it. Sorry, England. So what we're talking about is intensity of experience, intensity of emotional engagement. So watching football is quite strong emotional engagement. It's quite, in a sense, gross. I don't mean to put a downer on football, it's okay. Listening to me talk about Buddhism is probably going to have been a more subtle experience for you. You might, maybe, hopefully you're a bit excited, hopefully you're interested, hopefully you're engaged. And yeah, I don't expect to excite the same strength of emotional responses you would have when Ryan Giggs scores in the 89th minute to go 2-1 up there. That would be a stronger emotional experience. That's fine. What we're looking for in Buddhism is making a shift into more subtle experience. We're making a shift towards, yeah, just a more subtle experience of life. Hopefully one that's more refined. Could say more about that, but for the moment I'll just give you that point. But when we're talking about shifting away from passion, we shift from gross passions to subtle passions to no passion. There's loads more to be said about this, but the time says that I need to press on. So yeah, just to evoke more beautifully that shift from passion to more refined passion. Cut off your sticky attachment in the manner of a man who plucks with his hand an autumn lotus. Cultivate only the path to peace, Nibbana, as made known by the Exalted One. So I think this is the way in which to take what I was just talking about as making the shift from gross pleasures to subtle pleasures. It's not, you don't, although he does say cut off actually, but focus more on the bit where he says, the manner of a man who plucks with his hand an autumn lotus. That's an image of beauty, that's an image of refinement. Our own teacher, Sangharakshita, talks about not giving up gross pleasures, but growing up. So just as I'm sure, as we've all done, we can think of examples of this in our lives. There's things which we're very into, we're very attached to, and slowly over time we lose interest in them. We don't have to cut them off, we don't have to say that's bad and wrong. We just realise that there's a more fulfilling possibility. It's like a child growing up. As a child growing up, you slowly lose interest in your toys. As a child growing up, probably most of us as children liked extremely sugary, sweet foods. I know I did. As I grow up, my taste becomes more refined, more subtle. I become interested in more refined tastes and pleasures. And that's what we're trying to do with Buddhism. We're not trying to cut things off. We're trying to refine. We're trying to become more subtle. Because that, for me, is a more wholesome and positive and possible path. So I'm going to sum up now. So this is I'm just going to draw out the key points of what I think I've been talking about. And to try and give you a few things you can go away and consider and say, well, do I think this is true? Do I see how I could apply that in my life? Does it make sense? Do I want to do that? Because if you agree with these statements, then that means that you're in line with what the teaching of the Buddha, which presumably is a good thing. And if you're not, you can decide, well, maybe I don't agree with that. Maybe that's fine. Well, that is fine. Anyway. So what is Buddhism, in short? Buddhism is about key principles. It's based on the possibility of deep transformation. That deep transformation is based on universal principles, which we can align ourselves with and practice in accordance with. The main way we align ourselves with the universal principles is by taking responsibility for our own minds and actions, and using that responsibility to set up a future of positivity and beauty. Buddhism isn't about destroying the ego. It's about having a fantastic life whilst the ego simply slips away. That's what I say when people ask me, what's Buddhism about?